Blog Talk Radio.
Again, you are tuned in to Hear No Evil here on blogtalkradio.com. Call in number 347-989-0761. And I am your show's host and producer, Darlene Lewis, welcoming you and yours to the eargasms of your choice. Tonight, I'm focusing on producers, then and now. Tonight, we're going to have a special guest, Ron Lawrence, Ron Amon-Ra Lawrence, of the illustrious Hitman Productions of Bad Boy Entertainment. You know him from producing some of the hottest tracks, often associated with P. Diddy. So he will be calling in later on, but before he calls in to talk about his career and what projects he's working on now, I want to talk to you about a legend, Gordon Parks, whose work gets a centennial tribute. Now, long before folks like Russell Simmons and Beyonce were conquering music, movies, and magazines, Gordon Parks had reigned for decades as our culture's ultimate multimedia master. Best known for directing iconic films such as Shaft and authoring classic children's books like The Learning Tree, Parks was also a composer, a fashion photographer, and Essence's founding editorial director from 1970 to 1973. Now on the centenary of his birth, several art installations and a five-volume book of his personal photos and public works are honoring his legacy. Parks died in 2006. On November 8, New York Studio Museum of Harlem will be mounting an exhibition of Parks' most important photojournalistic endeavors. His haunting portraits of the impoverished Fontanelli family, shot for Life magazine in the late 1960s. Comprising about 30 images, the modestly sized yet emotionally powerful Gordon Parks, A Harlem Family, 1967, details the black urban condition during the civil rights movement. Now, the exhibition was meticulously assembled by Studio Museum Director and Chief Curator Thelma Golden and Assistant Curator Lauren Haynes. The display poignantly captures Park's unique talent for redefining popular notions of high culture and pop culture while speaking about humanity in its purest form. Please make sure you guys try to get to 125th Street just to check out the works of Gordon Parks, and I'll be right back.
See, I believe in money, power, respect. First you get the money, then you get the motherfucking power. After you get the fucking power, you move with respect. Money, power, respect, you needin' life. Money, power, respect, eatin' right. Money, power, respect, money, power, respect.
Yeah. Hey, yo, my whole clique bout it. We take yours while you pout about it. Truck, step out the horse, run a crowd around it. You can see me on Optimum TV. On your back from Turn the Light Out, scream Bloody Mary. 1, 2, 3, Chic ain't your usual friend.
Hi, you're joining Darlene Lewis. And on the air, I have the illustrious Ron Amon-Ra Lawrence. Hi, Ron, how are you?
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing? Thank you for calling in, and hopefully your fans will call in and get a dose of good information about the music industry and your career. Once again, thanks for calling in. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great.
Yeah,
now, listen, I just played a small snippet of a song that you were involved in, but before we talk about your Bad Boy involvement, I just want to take you back to when you first decided that you wanted to do the music.
Right. Yeah, when I first decided I wanted to do it, I must have been about 13 or 14 years old. I was in seventh grade, and, a bunch of friends, we were together, and we started messing with our parents' stereo sets. Actually, we were doing pause button tapes. We were listening to Grandmaster Flash and those guys. We were listening to Super Rappin' and Flashes on the Beatbox, and we wanted to mimic that. We rap more mellow and funky 4+1. And that's pretty much how it started. We kind of wanted to copy what they were doing.
So the pioneers were an influence in your life.
Oh, yeah, they definitely was. Yeah,
okay,
did
you tell your parents that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, they knew because, I had an older brother that was a DJ. He was jamming in the parks, and after that he was going into the clubs. So it wasn't before long before I started doing it. What I would do is I would mess with his equipment when he wasn't home. I would kind of mess up and scratch up his records and stuff, and he would come home and be pissed off. So, the best way for us to do it at the time, because we were so young and we didn't know what it was like to have real equipment, we just started messing with pause button tapes. And then eventually we started using the receivers, and we would take the balance knob, we would put one turntable, and we would stick it to, like, you know, the left speaker and the other turntable to the right speaker, and then we would do the balance knob thing. Yeah, so that's pretty much how it started.
Okay,
I was a DJ at first before I even started rapping.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask you. Were you a DJ first?
Yes, I was a DJ first, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So your influence was hip-hop. Okay, so now bring me a little closer to the before you got the actual deal. How did you go about, because I did my research, and I think I found a cassette, Two Kings and a Cypher.
Right.
So you got in, you some kind of way you became a recording artist. How did that happen?
Well, I eventually went to college, and actually I had, I was messing with music when I was in school, and, Herbie Lovebug was my friend, so he would,
Herbie Lovebug,
I was kinda,
and Pepper, and Kid
Right,
Sweat.
Right, exactly. Okay. I would kind of give him ideas and stuff, but, I mean, I'll fast forward, we could talk about that, but let me just kind of fast forward a couple of years later into that. But, you know, what kind of happened was the reason I had went to school was because I kind of felt like, you know, everybody else was doing something, so I needed to do something myself. And when I saw everybody getting into the music, I was kind of left to fend for myself. So I decided to go away to school because, there was really nothing going on for me at the time. And when I went to school, I met, people who got into the music business later on. You know, guys like Puffy and Mark Pitts and Hawk Pierre and just a whole bunch of other people.
So you guys met at the same college?
Yeah, we were all at the Howard together, yeah.
Wow.
And D-Dot, and we were all there together. So me and D-Dot decided to come together and put a group, which was Two Kings of Cypher. We put the group together, and I remember I went to took some of my financial aid money and bought this real big boombox radio. And I would take like a little stereo set, and we would use it. We would play one stereo. We would play one cassette from the stereo, and use the other box to record while we were rhyming. So we started doing that, trying to make like these little cheesy demo tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So, but eventually, what happened was I had gotten a small royalty check from Herbie Lovebug from doing the song. I was kind of lending my expertise to him to do a song for Salt and Pepper. I really didn't know how to work the equipment at the time, but I was giving him ideas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he would kind of put them together while I would sit there and kind of, construct and conduct or whatever you want to call
it. I'll Take Your Man? Was it that song?
It wasn't, but I was involved with that. The drum pattern was mine, but I didn't get paid for that one. I had gotten paid for a record called Hyped on the Mic.
Okay.
And,
wait, the one that goes, My Mic Sounds Nice? Not that.
Well, My Mic Sounds Nice, that particular one, the Go-Go.
Mm-hmm.
That was my idea, the Go-Go. The Go-Go part that you hear in the record, because when I was living in D.C., I was around Go-Go music.
Mm-hmm.
So I would send him, I would give him the Go-Go ideas, and then he would take them. And he would put them in the songs, and then he would make them what they were. You know, I mean, I'm not taking credit because he didn't produce those records.
Right.
I was just giving him ideas.
Right.
And then he would put them into the, and then he would produce it himself. But the Go-Go, yeah, the Go-Go was my idea. Yeah, he took those and he made them into those records. But where I got credit was when I actually took put a record together for him. On the NPC 60 with assistance from a very good friend, like a brother to me. His name was Wizard ME, and he knew how to work the NPC 60, and he assisted me, and then we came up with the song Hyped on a Mic, and I gave it to Herbie with the disc, and he used it, and I was able to get a royalty check from that, and with that royalty check, I was able to buy equipment. But the funny thing about it was I wasn't going to buy a drum machine. I was actually going to buy a used 19, I can't remember the year, but it was a used Jetta. And my father didn't want to put me on his insurance.
Mm.
So I couldn't get the car. And I remember I was trying to impress this girl. And so he said, no, I'm not going to do it, but you can use my car if you really want a car down up at college. So I said, all right. So I took him up on an offer. And a partner of mine was like, you know, why stress it? Why are you trying to buy a car when you just go ahead and buy a drum machine? I mean, this is what you like.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about it that same night. The next morning I called him up and I said, all right, you know what, you're right. Why don't you take me to the music store? It was a store called Chuck Levin's up in Wheaton, Maryland. And so he took me down to the music store and I bought an NPC 60. And once I got that, started making beats from there. And we worked on a demo. D-Dot and I worked on a demo in my dorm room.
So wait a minute. Now, you and D-Dot shared the same dorm room?
Well, we became roommates after the fact. But when I first got the drum machine, we weren't sharing at the time.
And there was no original RAs that was knocking on your door saying, what's that noise you guys are doing in here?
I never really had complaints because I was further up on a higher floor. But the funny thing about it was, people that didn't know, they would come to my room because at the time, it was unheard of for somebody to have a drum machine in a dorm room or even at a college campus for that matter. I was like the first person to have a drum machine on Howard's campus.
That's great.
Yeah, so people would be like lined up just to come to my dorm room just to hear beats.
So now how did you meet Puff?
I met him at Howard. I was like a year ahead of him, so I met him for his freshman year. And you know, he was always a cool, slick, dressing cat, real neat, dancing, flamboyant. No, you were cool.
So you and D Dot, you do this song, you get a demo, I guess, to somebody, and you wind up getting a deal. Was it that easy?
No, it actually wasn't that easy because a friend of mine knew a gentleman by the name of Haq Islam. Haq Islam was an A&R at Philadelphia International Records. It was a record company that was run by Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff.
Right.
And for those who don't know who that is, Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff was responsible
for
the sound of Philadelphia sound. Right.
Yeah.
So he expressed that he wanted to manage us after hearing what he heard when he came to my dorm room. So we had a meeting, and then took him up on the offer, signed a management contract, and then we went out to Philadelphia International and we started recording.
Did Haq Islam manage Jodeci also at one time?
No, he had Drew Hill and Maya.
Drew Hill. I knew it was a group he had. Okay.
So we were his first act. We were his first act before Drew Hill and Maya.
Wow.
That's
crazy.
Yeah. So we would take weekends, and we would drive out to Philly like every other weekend, and we would record the Studio 309. And we had access to all the 24-track masters.
Mm.
Yeah, we would listen to Lovers. We would actually listen to the 24-track of Love Is a Message and records like You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else. I mean, everything was right there.
Mm.
That was like the most amazing thing, just to be able to experience and witness that.
That's
and just
amazing.
Getting the knowledge from Kenny Gamble. You know, it was a great
That's
thing.
Great.
But we were going to get signed. We were going to get signed to Philadelphia International. But they weren't putting out records at that time, so he directed us to another gentleman that worked at RCA, a promoter by the name of Greg Peck, who got a record deal. And but we went to almost every record label and got turned down until Greg Peck decided to sign us. But you know, that's the craziest thing when you're trying to get a record deal when nobody knows who you are.
Right.
This is tough, you know.
Okay, so you did the deal. You seen how it was to actually be involved with the music industry, with the studio. Take the listening audience, and we also have callers calling in from Atlanta. We have so many people calling in probably that want to shout you out. But take us to how did you become a producer for Bad Boy? Like, how did that whole thing come about, and what was that experience like? Because I'm trying to connect the dots, because every time you talk, I still think about, good thing he didn't get the money for the car, you know? Because had you done that, it would have been a whole nother life for you, you know? So take us to that point when Puff remembered you, I guess, from college.
Yeah, well, what happened was Puffy, when we were working on the demo, we were supposed to give him almost like the first disc. We were supposed to let him hear it before anybody else. But it didn't go down that way because Islam had control of that. So because I remember meeting him on college campus when he had left Howard, and he started A&R for Andre Harrell. He told me that he wanted to get the demo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it just never happened. And so when things didn't go well with the record company and And I had moved out to L.A. to kind of like, you know, try to further my career. And the reason I did it was because Shy had, they also had went to Howard University, and they had this big hit, If I Ever Fall in Love.
Oh,
and one
yeah.
of the guys, in the, in one of the members in the group, me and him, he got kind of cool. And he told me that to fly out to L.A. so I could work with him.
Mm.
So so I did that. And D-Dot left D.C., and he moved back to New York because things were kind of slow.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually started road managing for Mary J. Blige. While I was in L.A., I would send beats to him, and he would shop them for me.
Mm.
So we eventually got a record. We got a record placed with Jam Master Jay on the show soundtrack. It was a song called What's Up Star by Sugar. That was the first song that we landed.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and we were getting our hustle on. We were doing different records like that OG and the Bulldogs and these little twos and fews. We were getting like little money here and there.
Mm-hmm.
So when things didn't really, and then we did a song for Shy on the second album. D-Dot rapped and I did the track. And but when things didn't really work out well, I decided, like, I need to go back to New York. And D-Dot was telling me, like, well, you need to come back on the East Coast because this Bad Boy thing is popping off. So I moved back to New York. And
so now you moved back to New York. Where did you stay? Did you stay with your parents? Did you get your own place?
No, I stayed with my brother in Mount Vernon. I had to explain to him what was going on, and he just said, hey, man, just, you know, just come. You can live with me. Until you get back, until you get on your feet.
And this is your brother that was the DJ?
No, this is another brother. This is, I have like five brothers, but this is another brother. The other brother, the one that's the DJ, he lives in Houston now. But the other one, my older brother, Derek, lived in Mount Vernon. He was the politician guy. He was running for mayor at Mount Vernon at the time. But he said, yeah, you can come stay with me, but you got to help me run for mayor. And I was just like, at the time, I couldn't stand politics. So it's like every morning I have to go out to the subways with him and, you know, sign ballot petitions, whatever you want to call it. And, man, I couldn't stand it, but that's what I had to do.
And did you meet Heavy D while you was out there?
No.
Because you're saying Mount Vernon. Because I'm like, wow, what a perfect place for you to be.
But, but Alicia Keys, I remember, but we'll talk about that. Alicia Keys that came out to Mount Vernon, but this was after one of the records came out. But so then what happened was when I was living in Mount Vernon, D-Dot would come. He would come up to the house, and we would work on music together.
Mm-hmm.
So as time went along throughout that year, I think it was like 1995.
Mm-hmm.
D-Dot was like, Puffy is about to, he's about to put a coup together, and he's calling it the Hitman, and you need to sign because I'm playing him the tracks, and he likes them.
Mm.
So, and I'm like, I was like, yeah, that's hot, but if I'm going to sign, you need to come too.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, nah, I'm not going to do it because, you know, at the time he wasn't really making beats. He was like, nah, you know, I want to be a manager. That's what I do. And I was and I was telling him, I was like, well, you know, we're in this together. We got this far. So if I'm going to sign, you need to sign too. So kind of to do a convincing thing. And he said, okay, cool. We sat down with Puff, and we had this big meeting.
Did you have a lawyer at the time?
Yes, Edwards was my lawyer. I don't know if you know who Edwards is, but Edwards is the guy who represented Corey Gunn's and Corey Gunn's reality show.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I was like his first client when he first opened his doors. D.I. and I were the first guys that he represented.
Wow.
So yeah, so we sat down with Puff, and Puff expressed that he wanted to leave a country and go to, like, another island to work on music. And it was me, D-Dot, Stevie J, and Nasheen Marek. And he told us he was forming this crew called the Hitmen. And he kind of wanted to get away from all the riffraff and everything that was going on at the time in New York with the whole Death Row Bad Boy situation. And so he went away. He went away. He expressed that he wanted to take over the music industry by storm and run the airwaves and the whole nine. He had it all planned out. It was just, it was like some Motown type of thing. He had it all mapped out. It was crazy.
Wait. So he took you and D-Dot. Was it just you two at first?
No, it was me, D-Dot, Nasheem, and Stevie J.
Stevie J from Hip Hop Atlanta.
Yep. Right.
Okay.
Right.
So now, with all of you guys being such great producers, did egos ever come into play? Like, how was that working, you know, with each other, with each one of you? Did you guys all work on one song together, or did you guys work on different songs together?
Well, we usually partnered up. We were partnered.
And
up.
How
like,
was that?
Diddy
like,
would partner with Diddy. I would partner up with Dot. Nasheem had a partner by the name of Carlos Brody.
Okay.
We would partner up and we would do our thing. Every once in a while, we would kind of like intermingle, meaning like, you know, I may switch and go with Nasheem, or Nasheem would go with D-Dot or something like that, and they would work on something. But for the most part, we had our little cliques.
But it was about then, 8 or 9 of you. It was like a...
Yeah, eventually it became
Chucky
that.
Chucky Thompson and Yogi. You had all of these
right.
people.
Eventually, yeah. Diddy started signing more and more, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Okay.
But originally, he worked with like a small unit of like when we worked on No Way Out, and when we worked on the Biggie's second album, it was like four of us that he worked around, and then eventually he started using, you know, other producers, and it got to like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. But at the time, Chucky wasn't really involved as much at the time when we were working on the Biggie second album and the No Way Out album, because he had gotten a label deal. Chucky was at the beginning when, you know, working with the My Life album and the first big album, you know.
Okay.
So, but eventually, within the next year or two, when things started to get big, he started bringing in more producers, and then became like 9, 10, 11 producers.
And how was that experience for you? Like, because it seems like it happened. I mean, you definitely hustled. It wasn't an overnight sensation, but when you did get it in, did you expect the impact that you make? Because I don't think you, I mean, you're so humble, and I don't think you realize.
Let me tell you this story. It's so crazy, because I was about to leave. I was going to leave Bad Boy my first year in when I signed, because I was getting overshadowed by the other three producers that were getting all the work.
Mm.
And I remember I wasn't making no money, and I wasn't getting anything placed. But I'm not sure if Puffy knew exactly what I was doing. So I had a meeting with him one day and told him that. Well, okay, before I get to that, when I was explaining to him that I wasn't really getting a lot of work, because I would give him cassettes and stuff, and he would kind of like, you know, wouldn't really listen to him. He was like, yeah, I'm going to listen to this. And then when I asked him, did you listen to this cassette? He's like, nah, well, you know, I don't know where I put it. I'll give another cassette and we'll do the same thing. And it was like every other day, it was a situation. And then I would play him tracks, and then he would tell me, nah, you know, that ain't it. So it's like I would have to go to the drawing board and start all over again, because my sound at the time was very, very, very dark. I had a very, very dark, grungy sound, and it really didn't fit the format for what he was looking for, you know. So then I said, okay, well, maybe I could start taking my tracks and start playing them for the artists. So tracks that he would pass on, I would say, well, let me see if the artist would like it, because I remember I played him the Been Around the World track, and I played him this track called I Love You Baby and a couple other tracks, and he passed on them. He was like, nah. He was, Buffy had an ear where he could listen to something in like the first 3 seconds, and he could tell you if he liked it or not. So when I played him songs, like, he would listen to the first 5 seconds, and he'd be like, next. And then he eventually said, you know, nah, that's it. So then after a while, I got a little fed up. I said, you know what, I'm going to take these tracks and be playing for the artists. So I played it for Black Rob. At the time, Black Rob, nobody knew Black Rob was. Black Rob heard the record, I Love You, Baby. He flipped out. He was like, yo, you did this track? I was like, yeah. He went, he wrote to it.
Mm.
Recorded it. So then I'm sitting with Mace. Mace said, you got any tracks? I said, yeah. So I'm playing Mace some tracks. He hears the Been Around the World track. He flips out. He's like, yo, I want this track. You know?
David Bowie? That's the David Bowie sample?
Right. So he goes and he records the track. Buffy had artists at the time that were self-contained. Like, you really didn't need to be in the studio. They were so good that you didn't need to be in the studio to coach most of them. So they were going and they would record themselves and come back with the songs. And then Bobby hears the songs and then he flips out. And then he comes in and says, okay, you know what? I'm going to take this verse right here. And he goes to Black Rob and says, I'm going to take that verse. And then he takes the records and puts them on his album. Those, mind you, those songs were supposed to be for their album, but they ended up on his album after he heard them. So...
But could he do that? I guess he could because you were signed to him.
Of course he did. That was his label. So then I go to him towards the end of my first year contract, which was about that. My contract was for 5 years, but within the first year, it says if I don't make a certain amount of money, I can walk out, go free. So then I go to him, and then I say, hey, you know, things ain't really working too well for me here. I don't feel like I'm getting the notoriety that I deserve. Like, I feel like I'm just as good as all the producers that you have here, but I don't feel like, you know, I'm getting, like, you know, the proper just due. And then this is around the time Biggie had just got killed. So I believe I could have caught him at a vulnerable stage where, you know, he was just kind of just, you know, willing to listen to me, or the fact that he just kind of respected that I came to him man to man and just said told him how I really felt.
Right.
And he said, yo, you know what? I'm going to change it. You know, I've been hearing what you've been doing. I really like what you do, and I want to keep it. I'm going to change it. And he said, go home and put all your songs together. We were using DATs at the time. We weren't really, there were CDs, wasn't, you know, CD burners wasn't around. So we'd use DATs. He said, go home and put all your stuff on a DAT and then come back. You know, I'm going to hook you up. So drove back to Mount Vernon where I was staying. I put, like, for 2 days straight, every single song, track that I had, I made sure that I had them on DAT. It must have been like 50 tracks. And I came back and I gave them the DAT. And you know, it's like one day I walk in the Bad Boy and everybody's writing to my songs. I walk to the MIDI room, I walk in the studio, every studio, and everybody's writing to my songs. It was just like,
he didn't want to lose you.
No, but the thing about it was crazy to me that it was just one day I went from, like, not hearing none of my music in the studio to every song, every track was my song.
Wow.
But it happened so fast because before I knew it, it's like I'm turning on the radio and then I'm hearing all my records. It's like one after the other. It was just amazing.
Okay, so now when you gave him this stuff to listen to or whatever, your stuff was copywritten and all of that before you did all of that, I hope.
Well, I mean, I'm in the camp of Bad Boy, so it really didn't matter. You know, but I know what you're saying, but because I'm under a management. You know, but if I was giving it to somebody else, it would have been a different story. But I'm under his management, so I'm giving him my tracks. So
okay, but my thing is, okay, let's say
for instance, I have a contract signed to him. So for me to be copyrighting my stuff because he has it, that's, you know.
But I'm saying in the event that somebody's writing to your stuff that's not signed to him, or
we didn't do that back then.
So it was in-house writers.
It was in-house writers, yeah.
So it was like a Motown. It was basically like a hip-hop, R&B, modern version of Motown. And he was very sporty.
Right.
And you were the Funk Brothers.
Yeah, we were the Funk Brothers, yeah.
And Norman Whitfield and everybody else. That was it was you were like the modern version of Motown. Okay,
right.
So
and everybody played their part. Stevie J, Stevie J had the instruments. He knew how to play almost. Yeah, he knew how to play almost every instrument, so he would do a lot of the overdubs.
Stevie
J, right? And Dita Angeletti, he took care of the studio operation where he made sure all the artists got there on time and everybody was doing what they had to do. So he managed. He pretty much managed the studio.
So you programmed the beats.
And I was kind of like, excuse me?
You program all the beats.
Yeah, I program beats. Everybody programmed their own beats.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, everybody programmed their own beats. But for me, you know, I was fortunate because at that point in time, all the songs that I had on a DAT, you know, Puffy would he would kind of go to that particular DAT and he would pull from it. So he would take me places when he would have he had meetings with the artists. But if it was like, you know, a Mariah Carey or a LL Cool J or Boyz II Men, he would take me with him, and then he would have me play the tracks, and if they liked them, we would throw them right then and there. So I had to be ready, prepared with all my equipment and my disc. Yeah, so that became like a special situation, you know, that I created, because it was like, okay. It had a lot of radio-friendly records on it.
Okay.
So everybody had a particular style. If you needed a certain type of sound, if you needed a sound for the streets that was grimy, you went to Nosh. You know, if you needed a radio single, you would come to me. If you needed, you know, a certain sound from that was to D-Dot, you would go to D-Dot. If you wanted a certain sound for Steve, you know, for Stevie, something musical and R&B, you go to Stevie J. You know, if you wanted a certain sound, you know, Stevie and Chucky was pretty much similar. So everybody kind of had their own niche at the time.
Now let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Now, you said that you had spoke to Puffy around the time Biggie passed, but weren't you involved with the Hypnotize track?
Yes, I was, yeah.
So you spoke to him after you did...
I produced the Hypnotize track, yes.
I'm sorry.
Even right around the time Hypnotize came out, yeah. Because even around that time when Hypnotize was done, I still wasn't getting, the song hadn't blown up at the time.
Oh.
So it didn't have that impact. And I still wasn't getting the notoriety and the work that I thought I should have deserved at that time.
Okay, so now... once you got the notoriety and then the song started hitting, then I guess you get a certain amount of points or whatever, you know, for doing certain, you know, sales or whatever. Like, when did you start seeing your money? Because you were involved with so many projects. Like, how did you survive if you weren't getting paid?
Well, the first year I wasn't getting paid. And the reason why I wasn't getting paid was because I wasn't getting work.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started getting work, I started getting paid.
So your money came from the budgets of the artist?
Yeah. So
okay.
What would happen is, you know, it was so easy at the time because if you had a particular song and you got a track, the check was ready for you right there. It's not like how it is today where somebody takes a track And then they say, well, you know, I'm going to write to this track, and I'll get back to you.
Mm.
So, and sometimes when that happens, you don't know, because of the power of Pro Tools, they take these tracks and then they record them, and they can record up to like 10 or 20 songs. And then once they figure out what songs they want to use, it could be like 6 months, 7, 8, 9, 10 months down the line. So now the album is done. Then you get a phone call that they want to use your song. So then you do a contract, and then you get, like, your first half, second half, or whatever. But it just, when we were in the game doing it like that, that's not how we did it. If they liked your track, you got that check right there. And when we got hot, when we got, see, at the beginning, we were strictly in-house. We weren't going out to get tracks placed. Everything was right there. We had Maze, we had Big, we had Faith, we had The Locks, we had Black, we had everybody. So we didn't have to go out to try to place tracks with anybody. So when those records started coming out, the phone started ringing. When the phone started ringing, if they wanted the song, you gave them a fee. And then before they even heard the song, they had to pay the fee. That's how it was with me. So they're like, well, what's your fee? It's X amount of money. Cut the check. You know, sometimes they'll walk in the studio with the check and be like, here, here's the check. We want three tracks.
Now, you're licensing them. You're not giving them the songs, right? They were like just, you still own the music. Or
right,
did
you're
you
producing
just
for them. You're producing. They're coming with the check, and they're saying, here, here's the check. Then we do the contract.
Right.
But they know what your fee is.
Okay.
So you sign a producer declaration,
mm-hmm.
and then you do a full-form contract. But the good thing about it was you got the money up front. It's
wow.
not like you have to go play the songs,
mm.
and if they like the songs, then they cut the check.
Mm.
So basically, it's even worse.
No, because I'm trying to figure out, because nowadays these artists are spending frivolous monies before they even know whether or not their songs are going to hit. Like, who's benefiting more, the producers or the artists now, or the labels? Like, who's benefiting now more? Because it's different.
Yeah, but like I said, because of the power of Pro Tools,
mm-hmm.
Pro Tools is a software that allows
right.
them to record in their
mm-hmm.
own home or anywhere. They don't have to use a studio. All they gotta do is take a CD version of the track and put it in Pro Tools and demo your song. But they're demoing. It's being demoed in the state of our quality.
Right.
So and whatever they demo can very well be used on the album. So mm-hmm. they don't need. At the beginning, but they don't have to pay you. So
now,
what
they're paying you in advance royalty, but
no,
you're still going to make money off the sales, right?
Excuse me?
Do you make money off the sales?
Yes, you make money off the sales. Yes,
okay.
You make money off the sales, yes.
I'm just trying to make sure you didn't just get a check one time and then.
No.
Okay.
Well, the way it works, this is the way it works. Okay? You do a contract.
Mm-hmm.
They pay, it's called an advance. An advance is money that's advanced to you from royalties.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say royalties is like $1,000. Or let's say royalties is $100,000, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You get they pay you a check of, let's say they pay you a check of 10 grand or 5 grand or 30 grand, okay? At the beginning when you do the song, that's called an advance. That the advance, there's money that's advanced to you towards your royalties. Your royalties are your future payments that you get once the record starts to sell. So you get 15, 20, 25, 30,000, whatever. Once you get that money is deducted from your royalties. But that money, the record has to sell first. So once the record sells, and it's called recoupment,
mm-hmm.
everything gets recouped. You know, the studio costs, this, that. Whatever, the whole album. So once it's recouped and all the money is paid out, then you get paid the royalties. So they deduct that from your money. So now if you get a $100,000 check, whatever money was given to you from the beginning is deducted from that. So if you got 5 grand, your check is $95,000.
Right. That's okay, now, let's say, is it strange for a label to say that certain things cost something so that you don't get a certain amount of money from your royalties? Because they may say, well, we had expenses, blah, blah, blah. And do you ask for receipts? Or do you have an accountant that's tracking the spending of the labels, or people don't take time to do that?
Well, the royalty statement is supposed to show all that. Like, if you, only thing that's really you get charged for would be like if you use a sample or something like that.
Okay. Now, do you have to know in advance that a sample fee, what the sample fee is? Or you don't get involved in that?
Huh?
Did you get involved with the sample fee?